three lectures left in this course, and there will be two on free entropy, so it will be today and in 2 weeks. And I want to announce that next week we have a guest lecturer, so Uwe Hagerup will talk about Brown measure, which is also much related with free probability theory, but it will be somehow independent of my talk. So I want to talk about free entropy, which is one of the main topics in free probability theory. And today I want to talk about it mostly from the point of view of large deviations. And then in 2 weeks I want to talk about it from the view of operator algebras, in particular show how it can be applied to get results about the free group factors. Okay, so today it's about free entropy from the point of view of large deviations. So a big part of the lecture will be about the classical theory of large deviations, just to give you some idea what this is about. And yeah, but let me start with free entropy. So free entropy should be, in free probability theory, the analog of the classical notion of entropy, which plays, of course, a big role in classical probability theory. And there is a quite evolved theory of free entropy, but it's also quite technical and it's full of problems. So actually there are more or less two theories of free entropy. So we have two things which we call free entropy. So namely, there's one thing which we call chi, and then there's another thing which we call chi star. And I mean, both are coming from different approaches to free entropy, and chi is defined via microstates. So this is in the spirit of the classical approach of Boltzmann to entropy, and this is also related to large deviations. So that's the one about which I'm going to talk. Okay, but there's also another one, which is usually called microstates-free free entropy, meaning it doesn't use the microstates definition. So this is the microstates-free approach to free entropy. Too many frees, yeah. This is really a free subject. Okay, and this is more coming from this is a statistical approach, which is mostly based on the notion of Fisher information. Okay, so I'm not going to the main thing here, Fisher information. So I'm not going to talk about this, but of course the idea is that actually both things should give you the same object in the end. But at the moment we don't know. I mean, we know that there's an intersection where they give the same. We know some nice properties of this quantity. We know nice properties, but usually other properties of this quantity. But the hope, of course, is they should agree, at least for many situations, and they should have all these nice properties. So that is what usually is going under this unification problem, where actually this is the same, or at least for many situations it should be the same. Okay, but we don't know. I mean, this is still open. Okay, so the theory of free entropy is not really yet in the final state. I mean, there are a lot of technical problems, but nevertheless, I mean, there's a whole body of theory, and actually we have applications to operator algebra. So that's what I'm going to talk about next time. But today I will concentrate on this idea that we are looking from the point of view of random matrices. This entropy should be the rate function in the large deviation principle. Okay, so what do I mean with this? So what we know from Voiculescu's generalization of Wigner's theorem is that if I have, let's say, independent Gaussian random matrices, let's say P of them, so the ANs are n by n Gaussian random matrices, they are independent, then we know that in distribution, if n goes to infinity, they converge to a semicircular family of p free semicirculars. Semicircular family. And of course, this is the family which generates the free group factors. That's, of course, the reason why we are so much interested in those. So the phenomenal algebra generated by this S1 up to Sp is the free group factor of the free group with p generators. Okay, so this is saying us that random matrices, the Gaussian random matrices, if n goes to infinity, really somehow concentrate on on these three semicirculars, or I mean, if you want to say it from operator algebraic point of view, they are giving you most likely the free group factors, the generators of the free group factors. But of course, you can also ask, how likely is it to see other distributions or for Neumann algebras in the limit? Of course, I mean, everything will concentrate on this, but nevertheless, if n is large, you might be close to other distributions. Of course, the probability is not very big, but at least you should see something, and maybe you can control or say something about this probability. And maybe let me make this a little bit more concrete. In a one-dimensional case, where I only have one matrix, because this is really the case where one can deal concretely with things. I mean, but from the operator algebraic point of view, of course, I'm interested in having several matrices or operators. The one-dimensional case is not really interesting, in a sense, because this is just about one cell-joint operator, which, of course, we understand. Okay, but nevertheless, I mean, it's very good to start from that to get some idea, and actually the one-dimensional case is the case where you really can calculate and prove things. Well, I mean, in the one-dimensional case, those two things are the same. Okay. Good, so but let us see what we have there. So for the one-dimensional case, so let us consider only one Gaussian random matrix, and so this means we have a probability measure on the space of n by n matrices. Let me denote this by Pn. This is our probability measure on the space of n by n self-adjoint matrices. And this probability measure, of course, is given by our prescription that the entries of our Gaussian random matrix should be independent and each of them should have a Gaussian distribution. Of course, independence up to the symmetry condition. Okay, so this should be probability measure on our Gaussian random matrices. So this means if our matrix, if we denote the entries by Aij, then this is a probability measure on the entries, essentially saying that they are independent. Okay, so if we run it like this, so it's given, of course, by a constant to normalize it to a probability measure. Of course, this will depend on n. Okay, but we don't bother about this. Then, on the diagonal, because we have symmetry, we have only real parts of our random variables. I have to be real, and they should be Gaussian, so they should have a density Aii squared, and the variance is 1 over n. Huh? So that's the reason that we have to factor here. Then, on the off-diagonal, let's say above the diagonal, below the diagonal, of course, it's the same, the real part and the imaginary part should also be independent, and each of them should be Gaussian. So the real part of Aij should be a Gaussian one, which has a density e to the minus n over 2, real part of Aij squared, and the same for the imaginary part, e to the minus n imaginary Aij squared. Okay, and maybe it's suggestive to write the collection of all those differentials of the entries just as dA. So what I have here, the constant times dA, and then of course I have these Gaussian factors. Okay, but of course they fit together nicely in a trace operation. I mean, if I write it like this, it looks as if I just have n squared minus n independent Gaussian random variables, but of course I'm thinking of them as being arranged in a matrix, and actually, I mean, what I have here is really nothing else than e to the minus n over 2, the trace of A squared. So this really has something to do with the trace. Okay, and the differentials I just write as a dA. Okay, so that's our probability measure. I mean, this constant is... Which one? Maybe. Or maybe n over 4. You say it should be half. Okay. I mean, it should be such that you get this one here.
Okay.
Okay, but. Yeah. Okay, so. So think about this, what it should be. Okay. Okay, and so that's our probability measure. And then what we are interested in, what Wigner's theorem tells us about, is the, what happens with the eigenvalue distribution of such matrices. Also, if I have a self-adjoint matrix, N by N matrix, then the eigenvalue distribution, or the empirical eigenvalue distribution, is a probability measure which puts mass 1 over N on each of the eigenvalues. Delta lambda 1 up to delta lambda N. Also, this is a probability measure. I mean, it's a nice way of encoding information about the eigenvalues. So that's the eigenvalue distribution. And where the lambdas are the eigenvalues of A, and then Wigner's semicircle law tells us that if N goes to infinity, this quantity converges weakly to the semicircle. I mean, it converges either in average or almost surely. But so what this, in a sense, tells us that if we are looking on a probability that mu A, so the probability of our matrix is such that mu A is close to Wigner's semicircle, that this goes from N to infinity to 1. If I'm saying mu A should be close to the semicircle, and I mean, I'm not very precise here. Huh? You should think about this of having somehow fixed, somehow a small neighborhood of this, and you're asking that this length into this neighborhood. I will make this more precise later, but for the moment we just want to state it in this form. So this probability converges to 1. This is more or less the same as saying that this converges to this. Also, in the limit, all the our probability concentrates on matrices whose eigenvalue distribution is very close to the semicircle. Good. Okay, but then, I mean, if you put it in this way, of course, you can ask, what is the probability that I see something else? Of course, the probability will be small, and it should go to zero if n goes to infinity, but nevertheless, I mean, can we somehow control how it goes to zero? Okay, so the question is, what is about the probability Pn that mu of A is close to some other distribution which is different from the semicircle? Okay, and what we expect, and I mean, I want to motivate this a little bit more, but what we expect is that actually, I mean, this probability goes to zero, but it goes exponentially to zero with n squared, and there is a factor in the, of the n squared, and that's somehow a rate function which somehow carries some information about this nu. So what we expect is that the n of this probability should behave asymptotically if n goes to infinity, like e to the minus n squared. And here we have a coefficient which depend on nu, and that should be the free entropy. I mean, this is a kind of large deviation statement, so in this context this is the rate function, but from the point of view of free probability, this here actually should be the free entropy. Good. Okay, so why do we expect this, or I mean, how does this fit into large deviation? Maybe in order to see this, we should somehow look on the corresponding classical problem. I mean, here we are looking on random matrices, on the Gaussian random matrices, and we can consider a corresponding classical problem where we have diagonal matrices, and we are choosing the entries on the diagonal independent with a given distribution. Okay, so then let us look on this, because then we are really back to the classical theory of large deviation. And I mean, from this point of view, it really becomes clear that this should be some kind of non-commutative loss of a large deviation. Okay, so we consider a corresponding classical problem. With independent eigenvalues. Of course, the eigenvalues of Gaussian random matrices are not independent. They have a very specific form of correlation, which I will talk about later. But let us consider the problem with independent eigenvalues, which means we are looking on an M by N random matrix, which is specified in the form that it should be diagonal, the DM should be diagonal. And the distribution is chosen in such a way that all the entries on the diagonal are independent and they have the same distribution. Okay, and this distribution we fix from the beginning, so that x is the mu. So all the entries on the diagonal should have the distribution mu. So all entries, lambda 1 up to lambda n on the diagonal, which of course are eigenvalues then of this matrix, are chosen independently, and they have the same distribution, so each of them has a distribution mu. Okay, and then what we want to consider is the eigenvalue distribution of this matrix, which of course is just the same as before, so it's 1 over n, delta lambda 1 up to delta lambda n, the probability measure which puts smart 1 over n on those eigenvalues, and then what do we expect? Of course we expect, from classical probability theory, law of large numbers mainly, that this guy converges actually to this mu, and that deviations from this should go to zero exponentially. So then, what one expects is that mu of dn converges to mu, and the probability of seeing something else in a limit, so that this eigenvalue distribution is close to some mu, that this goes to zero if mu is different from mu, and it goes to zero exponentially. And we should see some rate function, which of course carries some information about the property of mu, which actually should be the classical entropy. Okay, but that's what I want to talk about, because this statement here is mainly Zanoff's theorem in classical probability theory, and in the theory of large deviations, and that's what I want to talk about. Just to give you some idea what this is exponentially for mu, different from mu. Okay, so this is Zanoff's theorem, and actually, I mean, there's a precursor, reform of Zanoff's theorem, which is Gramer's theorem, which I first want to concentrate about. So I'm now switching essentially to the classical theory of large deviation to give you some idea what this is, and then in the very end, I hope I will come back to random matrices and being able to say a little bit more about this. Okay, so what? So, I mean, we have this situation, we have independent random variables, they have the same distribution, a given distribution, and I mean, actually, we're interested in this, but before I'm going to this, I want to look on the law of large numbers and see consider the large deviations for this, which will be Gramer's theorem. But actually, we can get some idea of Zanoff's theorem later on by using Gramer's. Okay, so the frame is we have random variables, a sequence of random variables, which are IID, and the distribution is mu, so this is a fixed probability measure, and what do we consider? I mean, we consider, as we do it in the law of large numbers, so we take the average of the first n of those, x1 to xn divided by n, and then of course by the law of large number, we know that if n goes to infinity, that this quantity converges to the mean. Well, so the mean is the most likely outcome which we see here. So the law of large numbers tells us that this n converges to m, which is the mean of all random variables. Well, they have all the same distribution, so there's only one mean around. Okay, then the central limit theorem refines this by telling us how we have the convergence in the neighborhood of m, but of course this convergence is somehow, this is stayed with n, so this is something which shrinks. So what the central limit theorem tells us that as n for large m looks essentially like the mean plus, and then we have a normal deviation, but this deviation, I mean the variance of this goes like 1 over n. So this is something which really shrinks to m if n goes to infinity. So it behaves like sigma squared divided by square root of m times the normal distribution of variance 1. So I have the n here. Also, this means for large n, I mean our random variable, has roughly a distribution about m, which is a normal distribution. And the width of this normal distribution is proportional to 1 over square root of n. Okay, so this means if n goes to infinity, of course this neighborhood shrinks. It's getting sharp, more and more peaked. Okay, and the high probability is only in smaller and smaller neighborhoods of m. But what we are now interested in are really large deviations, so that the question is, how big is the probability that we see somehow an average x which is here and which we don't scale? So which means if n is large, it's very far away. I mean, if n is large, all the probability concentrates in a very small neighborhood, and there's only a very small tail here. So the probability will be very small, but nevertheless, you can ask, how big is the probability, and can we say something about it? Okay, and that's something which we call an extreme event, or a large deviation from the mean. And because it's very large, it's not in the realm of the central limit theorem, because the central limit theorem is really the neighborhood shrinks if n goes to infinity. Okay, and the question is, can we say something about the probability of this? And maybe to get an idea what to expect, one can look at a very simple example where mu itself is a normal distribution, because then you can calculate everything, and then, of course, you can also get an idea what the probability here is. So I have an example. Let us take mu just as a normal distribution, mean 4 and variance 1, and then of course as n is the sum of independent Gaussians, so it's again a Gauss, and we only have to scale the variance. So as n as distribution, normal distribution with variance 1 over n. Because so we're adding up, but we're also dividing by n. So it has variance 1 over n, which means that the probability that Sn somehow close to x, I mean, this will be more or less, I mean, like the density of this distribution times dx or something like this. Let me just write it like this. This will be, so what is the density? It's e to the minus n x squared over 2. And then I have the factor which makes it to a probability distribution, I think, which is this one. Okay, so I mean we get this density, we get this m because we have here the variance 1 over n. And so what you see is that this behaves for large n, it goes exponentially to 0, it's a factor n, but there's a factor here which depends on x. So x is really the event which we are considering. So this behaves like e to the minus n times I of x. Okay, and the large deviation tells us that this is somehow a typical behavior. I mean, this is a very special situation where we can calculate things by hand. In general, you can't calculate it by hand. You can just do estimates. So you want to do estimates to see that this is somehow the order, how this such a probability goes to 0, the probability of a large deviation. So it should go to 0, like e to the minus, n is the number of degrees of freedom which you have, and then you have here a function, which is usually called rate function, which depends on the event which you are looking at. Good. Okay, so what we have here, maybe let me write it down a bit. So we have an exponential decay in n, and we have an I of x here, which is usually called the rate function. Okay, and here, of course, the rate function is very explicit. It's just x squared over 1/2, x squared over 2, and actually it is convex here. Yeah?
Maybe a silly question, but what about the square root of n?
Okay, we also have a dependence on n here, but if you write it as e to the minus, it will play no role. I mean, it's sub-exponential. This is just the asymptotic behavior. Okay, so of course, I mean, in general, you have to be careful. The normalization constant also depends on n, and it might, if it depends exponentially on n in the limit, then of course you get a contribution. So what we are interested in are the exponential contributions. Okay, but this doesn't go exponentially. It's a sub-leading term. Okay, yeah, good point. Good. Okay, so we have this rate function. Here, this is very concrete. It's convex, but I mean, one point, of course, is that it has a minimum, and this minimum, of course, corresponds to the most likely event, namely to x equal to 0 in this case, which is the mean. And then, of course, I mean, the probability shouldn't go to 0, but then it should go to 1. I mean, if x is equal to 0, then the limit everything concentrates here. Okay, so the minimum of the rate function really should correspond to what you get in the law of the large number. Okay, and now let us see whether we can make this more general. So now assume we don't look on this very special example, but can we somehow at least see a similar behavior for a general mu? Okay, consider now general mu. Okay, and of course, then of course we have no chance of calculating something explicitly, so we are going to make estimates, and then maybe I should be a little bit more precise. I mean, this is not very precise, so we should estimate the probability of some event, and let us maybe just say, instead of looking on this, we look on the event that our Sn is, let's say, bigger than x. I mean, the idea is that what is the probability of x? I mean, it should be the probability of a small neighborhood, but actually it should be more or less behaving the same way as taking the probability of everything here, because, I mean, it's getting even smaller here. So when looking at this interval, the main probability actually should come from this point here. So whether I consider the probability of that Sn is bigger than x, this is more or less the same as that Sn is in the neighborhood of x. Okay, so what you really can estimate are such things where you have to take concrete intervals. So what we consider in the following is the probability that Sn is bigger than x. Of course, if x is bigger than 0. If x is less than 0, you should look in the other direction. Okay, so can we estimate this somehow? Oh yeah, 0 is x. Otherwise, it would be trivial. Wouldn't be very interesting. Okay, so how can we estimate this? We want to get the order, which means essentially we are after two estimates. I mean, we want to estimate it from above. We want to see it goes to zero somehow, at least with this rate. But then we also want to estimate it from below. We want to see it doesn't go faster. Okay, and I mean, estimate probabilities from above usually is the easier part. So let us start with this. So the following x is bigger than 0. Okay, so what do we have? I mean, the probability that Sn is bigger than S. So what is this? This is the probability, of course, I mean, Sn is the sum of things divided by n. Better to get rid of this division. So let us look on n times Sn. So this is bigger than n times x, which we can also write as the expectation of the characteristic function in this event. So it's the event that n times Sn minus nx is bigger than 0. Okay, so this characteristic function. And now we do essentially a very rough estimate. Namely, we estimate this characteristic function by a kind of exponential function. So namely, we estimate. So we have here, a characteristic function, which is 0, let's say, and then it goes to 1. So that's the characteristic function for x bigger than 0. And we estimate this by an exponential, which essentially, just by e to lx, which of course, I mean, is bigger than this guy. It goes like this. So this is e to the lambda x. And actually, we can choose any lambda, but we leave it open for the moment. I mean, what we are doing is true for any lambda. I just estimate that this characteristic function is everywhere smaller than this one. So I can estimate this here by the expectation of e to the lambda times n Sn minus nx for any lambda. Lambda is, let's fix lambda for the moment, but leave it open. Okay, and what is this? I mean, I have here, x is just a number, so lambda nx, this is something which has nothing to do with the expectation. So this is e to the minus lambda n. And then I have here the expectation of what? I have e to the lambda, and what is n times Sn? This is the sum of my independent random variables. So this is e to the lambda, x1 plus xn. Okay, but now, I mean, you see, now we have here more or less the Fourier transform. We don't have the I here. Okay, so it's a moment generating function. So we have e to the sum of independent random variables, but then we know, of course, that this factorizes into the product because of the independence. So this here is nothing else than the expectation of e to the lambda of xi, I mean, doesn't depend on I, and then I have this n times. Good. Okay. And, I mean, you see, we want to write our probability as e to minus something, so we should also write this here as e to something. Okay, so we let us define the logarithm of this guy as a quantity which we call lambda, so we have lambda of lambda. Let us define this as the logarithm of e to the e lambda xi. I mean, this is information about our distribution mu. Huh? Essentially, it's a cumulant generating function. So this is the Fourier up to I. This is the Fourier transform of our distribution, and we are taking the logarithm of this. Okay, so this is the classical cumulant generating function of this guy. Cumulant generating function. And then you see that we have here the estimate. If we write it in terms of this, we have the probability that as n is bigger than 0, this can be estimated as less than e to the minus lambda n. Okay, and this, we're writing this as e to the lambda, and then we have the n here. So what we get here is plus n lambda of lambda. Or maybe which is the same, we can take out the n, because that's what we really want to see. We want to see n times something. E to the minus n times lambda x minus lambda of lambda. Okay, and this is true for all lambda. And of course, I mean, this is a very rough estimate. And of course, the lambda which we choose should depend on the x which we have here. I mean, what is good for one x might not be good for another x. But we have this for all lambda. So of course, what we should do is to take the infimum over this side over all lambda. Okay, so we also have so what we actually have seen is that as n bigger than x is less than infimum over all lambda of this function e to the minus n lambda x minus lambda of lambda. Okay, and if we are bringing this infimum here in the exponent, and because of the minus sum, minus sign, it will become a sub. So what we have here is actually e to the minus n. We want to write it as e to the minus n times something. And this something should be our rate function. Okay, and so what we have here is the sub over lambda of lambda x minus capital lambda of lambda. Okay, and I mean, maybe you have seen something like this, because this is a very well-known thing what we are doing here. I mean, what we are taking here is the Legendre transform of this lambda. This lambda is a convex function, and it's a very typical thing, in particular in statistical physics or so, to take Legendre transforms of convex functions. So actually what shows up here is the Legendre transform of lambda. So, I mean, it's quite easy to check that this function lambda is a convex function. And in such a setting, one defines a Legendre transform, and usually you don't know it by lambda star of x. So this is the Legendre transform of lambda. And this is the sub, it's defined as the sub over lambda, exactly as it shows up here, lambda of x minus lambda of lambda. Legendre transform. So this is another function of lambda. And actually, if you start from a convex one, you can show that this is again convex. Okay, good. So what we have seen here, I mean, at the moment we don't know whether this is the rate function, because this was just an estimate to the above, and I mean, we don't know how good we have done. It might be a very trivial estimate which doesn't tell us anything, but at least we have seen that we have that this probability is less than e to the minus n lambda star of x, where lambda star is the Legendre transform of this cumulant generating function. So where lambda star is the Legendre transform of lambda of lambda, which was the log of the expectation of e to the lambda xi. Okay, good. And now, of course, we have the question, how well have we done? I mean, is this a good estimate? Have we done it in such a way that actually what we get there really gives us a rate function, so that we that this at least gives us the right order of decay, or are we far away? So what we need is a corresponding estimate from below, where we see essentially the same kind of decay. Okay, and I mean, it will turn out that actually this is the rate function. I mean, otherwise I wouldn't have done this. Huh? Okay, so I mean, but at the moment it's not clear, because this is here quite rough estimate. Okay, but anyhow, it's good enough. Okay, so and what we want to show is that we can estimate this probability from below, which of course is somehow harder. I mean, we have to find sets which have high enough probability. I mean, here you only have to show the probability is not so big. Okay, but now the other way around, you really have to show the probability is big, is of this order. And this is usually the harder part. And actually, that in this case, we are not looking on this whole interval, but actually what we are doing, of course, it's enough to find the events which have high enough probability to find some small intervals. So actually we are looking just on a small interval about x, and we want to see that this probability has this exponential behavior. So what I want to do now, the other estimate, and so what we need for this is to show that the lim is n going to infinity of 1 over n, the log of the probability that as n is between x minus delta and x plus delta for some delta, that this can be estimated by bigger than minus lambda star of x for all x and for all delta bigger than 0. Because I mean this really means that this probability is bigger asymptotically than e to the minus n times this lambda star. Well, that's what we want to show. Okay, and I mean actually in general, I mean we don't know whether we have a limit here or not, so if we can show it for the limits, of course we are done. Good. Okay. That's what we want to do, and I mean first of all, let me point out that actually we can shift our problem to x equal to 0. So I mean, in principle, it's enough to do this for the case x is equal to 0. Because I mean, we can, if we subtract everywhere x in our problem, then you see that everything shifts, and you get the same problem here, which corresponds to x being equal to 0. Or maybe you can say what I'm doing in the following, you can more or less do it for general x. But I only want to do it for x equal to 0. But I mean, really, this is really enough. Okay, so by shifting, we can reduce this to the case x is equal to 0. Of course, the mean is not 0. Well, I mean, x equal to 0, I mean, we are in the general situation. I mean, x equal to 0 is really a large deviation from the mean, which is m. M is something else. Okay, and then maybe in this case, what is lambda star? I mean, lambda star of 0, or minus lambda star of 0. So what was lambda star? I mean, if x is equal to 0, this term disappears, so it's just a sup of minus this, or if you put the sup away, it's the int. If you bring the minus on the other side, so this here is actually the int of these lambdas. Okay, so this means what we have to show for x equal to 0, it's bigger than the int of this guy, which means essentially we have to show it's bigger than any of the lambdas. Or we should directly look on the inf. Good. Okay. And, I mean, the idea of proving this is a typical idea in large deviation principle. Namely, what you should do, essentially, you should try to change the measure from which you started in such a way that you are moving the x in which you are interested to the mean of your problem. I mean, in an original problem, x, which is now 0, is far away from the mean. Okay, but if you are somehow modifying the mu, then you can relate this to another problem where the x actually becomes the mean. And if you are on the mean, then by the law of large number, we know the probability which we have there. So the only point is whether we can connect these two problems. Okay, so, but this can be done in this case more or less concretely. So the idea for the proof is that we change the distribution mu of our random variables xi to some mu twiddle such that for the same problem under mu twiddle the x is the mean, such that x, which is 0 in our case, is the mean under mu twiddle. Okay, so how can you do this? Yeah, so let's... Yeah, I mean, that's a trivial change. That, there nothing has happened. I mean, yeah. This doesn't mean that I'm shifting x to the mean. Right? The mean is different from 0. Okay, I mean, if you want, you can do what I'm doing now also for general x. But essentially, you can reduce the case of general x to this case by somehow shifting the whole problem in a quite trivial way. I mean, that's not deep. Huh? Okay, that's really the point. I mean, okay, so I mean, maybe everybody has some idea how x should be shifted to x equal to 0, but I'm not sure whether anybody has an idea how I modify this mu here. No, I mean, we're not assuming that the mean is 0. I mean, you see, even if I start with something where the mean is 0, if I'm doing this shift, then of course I'm shifting the mean to something which is not 0 and the x is now 0. Huh? Okay, so... Ah, no, even then... Yeah, but I mean this... okay, I should have said x is bigger than the mean. Okay, that's what I meant. Yeah. Yeah, I mean the same. But if x is on the other side of the mean and you make the estimate that the probability that fn is bigger than this, I mean you shouldn't get an exponential decay, but you should go to 1, because then you include what happens about the mean. Good. So we consider. Let me only consider a case where maybe some special assumptions on lambda. Namely, let me assume that I have a unique minimum, which is not necessarily always the case. I mean, lambda of x is a convex function, and as it is written, it's also differentiable in lambda because it's the expectation of something. But I mean, it's not so clear that it's everywhere defined, but. If it is everywhere defined, then I mean lambda of x, I mean really, is something like this. Huh? And so this means it has a unique minimum, which we call eta. So that lambda of eta is really the infimum of lambda. And the derivative is equal to this. You have to see how it is defined. It's an expectation of e to the minus. It's like the Fourier transform. So I mean, you have to go into this, and from this, we check convexity. No. I don't think so. I mean, it's just about exponential function. I suppose it's Jensen's. Is it Jensen? Well, I don't know. It's related to something like this. Okay. And I mean this. So this. I mean we have a very concrete. It's an expectation of an exponential function. So.
And a log too.
And a log. Yeah. Good. Okay. But so. This is something one can check. Which is not. but it's not too hard. Okay, but I mean the point might be that we have a convex function which might be maybe show here and something like this. So it's not so clear that in the most general context this lambda is finite everywhere. Okay, but let us assume this, which of course is some kind of assumption on our starting distribution mu. I mean, the lambda is not the Fourier transform. The Fourier transform would be defined everywhere, but it's the moment generating function which might explode at some point. So, okay, so if you assume it is defined everywhere, this means we are assuming that the moments don't grow too fast. Okay, but in most cases we have this, and then, I mean, the lambda has a form like this. It has a unique minimum, which we call eta, at which point the derivative is equal to zero. And I mean, then of course, I mean, what we have to show, you see, we want this estimate about the infimum. So actually we have to show that we have lambda of eta here, that we have to estimate exactly with this eta, with this infimum. Okay, good. But how can we now show this estimate? And now the idea is that we should change our mu to mu twiddle, which somehow involves this data. So namely, we define a mu twiddle, which has a density with respect to our mu, and this density is exponential and involving this data. So it's e to the eta x minus lambda of eta. Oh, okay, so the x just shows up here, so it's essentially just an exponential change. This is just a constant number. Okay, but it's important to include this to make this a probability measure. Why is this? So let us sort of check this. That actually, I mean, with this change, I really have got a new probability measure. So what is the integral over R of d mu twiddle? So this is e to the minus lambda of eta, this is just a constant, and then I'm integrating e to the density, which is eta times x dx, du mu x. But this here, of course, is just the expectation of this guy here with respect to our mu. So this is the expectation of e eta of xi. Okay, but this was by definition of our lambda, just e to the lambda at this is times, at this point, lambda of eta. And now you see, I mean, I just have included this to cancel this away. So this is 1. Okay, so this factor is just there to make it a probability measure. Good. Okay, so I have a new probability measure. And now I can consider the same problem as before, for x's which are distributed with this mu twiddle. Maybe let me call them x twiddle. So consider now xi twiddle, iid, but the distribution is not mu, but this mu twiddle. And we ask the same question, namely we are looking on the average. So xn twiddle is now the average over this x twiddle. And, yeah, of course, first of all, we should see what is the average of this x twiddle. I mean, what I told you is we are changing the problem so that our x, which is 0, becomes the mean of those guys. Okay, let us check that we really have done it in the right way. Because then we know, I mean, if we have this, then by the law of large number, we know that this quantity goes to x. And then, of course, it remains to see that we can relate this problem with the other problem. Good. Okay, but let me first check. Yeah, what is the expectation under mu twiddle of the xi twiddle? So this is the integral of x, d mu twiddle of x. Okay, what is this? This mu twiddle has this overall factor e to the minus lambda of eta. Then I have x, e, then I have the density, eta of x, e mu of x. Okay, without this factor, this was e to the lambda, but if I have this factor here, of course what I'm doing is to take the derivative of this guy. So what I have here, this is nothing else than d divided by d lambda of e to the lambda of lambda at lambda is equal to eta. Because e to the lambda of this guy is just this here at lambda, and if I take the derivative of this, I just get one x down, which is this quantity. And then I evaluate it at lambda equal to this guy. No, at eta, because it's this eta here. I mean, this guy here is a function of lambda, so in general you have a lambda here. I mean, you're integrating over x. It's a function of this guy. Saying everything, because this is, I mean, this guy here is this expectation without the x. It's an integral. F, I mean, e to the lambda of lambda, this is the expectation of e to the lambda xi, which of course is the integral of e to the lambda x d mu x. If I take the derivative of this with respect to lambda, I get out this x, so I get exactly this quantity. And then I want to have it at the point eta. Good. Okay, but what is this? I mean, this derivative here with respect to lambda, this of course is this is just a derivative of the exponential, which is just itself, and then I get the derivative. Well, here I have to take the point eta, and then I get the derivative of lambda at the point eta. But now you see that eta was the minimum, so the derivative there is equal to zero. So this guy here is equal to zero. Actually, this piece here cancels. So what I get here is actually lambda prime of eta, but this was equal to zero, and zero was our x. Okay, so you see the average of the x twiddles under this new probability measure is zero. Just because the derivative of lambda at eta is zero. I mean, of course, eta, it's important that eta shows up here. Eta is the point where this derivative is equal to zero. Good, okay, so under this new problem, the point x equal to zero has become the point which is the mean, has become the mean of our problem. And for the mean, of course, we know that this here converges to the mean. So I mean that this is equal to zero or close to zero has very high probability going to one in the limit. Okay, so this probability we can control very well, but of course the question is, can we relate the probability that this is equal to x to the probability that the original Sn is equal to x? So can... Yeah, I mean, I just have a density.
And this shifts
the mean back to zero. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so this is just, one of the general procedure of shifting your mean. No, it's just exponential. I mean, this is just some factor. But I mean, you have to be careful. I mean, we are here in a very... this is very general. Of course, this lambda here has to be this logarithmic, this stimulant generating function. And I mean, of course, the point is that this eta is the minimum of this function. So I mean, you must choose this eta in a very specific way. Okay, but of course, I mean, this is very general for any mu. You can do this. Okay, but the point, of course, is first you have to calculate this lambda, the cumulant generating function, and then you must take the minimum of this, and this point you have to use for making this exponential change. But this shifts somehow the mean to zero. Good. Okay, then now, the main point, I mean, this, first of all, of course, this means we are looking at another problem, which is easier to solve, but I mean, of course, this problem should be related to the old problem. So let us see what we have. So for any epsilon bigger than zero, I mean, what we are really interested in is the probability that Sn is close to zero. So let's say between plus and minus epsilon. The question is, can we relate this with the probability that this guy here is close to zero? Yeah, so what is this? I mean, this is integrating with respect to mu over the set that is Fn is between plus and minus epsilon. So this means the sum over the xi, I from 1 up to n, is less than epsilon. And just integrating with respect to our product measure, describing the independent random variables. Oh, okay, so that's what this probability is. And now we are estimating this. I mean, we want to change this here to the mu twiddle. So we have to introduce this density p. So let me write it down. So first of all, I have here n epsilon eta integral e to the eta sum of the xi mu dx1 mu dxn. So what I want to have this density p here. The main point in main part in the shift is e to the eta xi. For each variable, I should have e to the eta xi. So if all of them, I would like to have this guy. And of course, if I'm doing this change, I mean, I'm changing here something, but because I'm only integrating over an interval, that is sum here is less than epsilon. So if I compensate this by, well, so I know on this, on the set over which I integrate, so it's the same set here, I know that the sum over the xi is less than epsilon. So the mistake which I have made here is less than this guy here. So if I multiply with this, I have at least this estimate. Okay, good. But then you see what I have here is more or less the same integral as before, but with respect to mu twiddle. But of course I also have to take into account that I need this additional factor here. So for each variable, I also get an e to the minus or plus lambda n, so I get it n times. So what I have here is actually e to the n times lambda eta in the integral over the same set here of mu twiddle d of x1 up to mu twiddle d of xn. Okay, and now we are quite close to what we want, because now with respect to this mu twiddle, the integration which we have here is the probability of this event, but for this situation with respect to mu twiddle. So what I have shown here is that this here is equal to e to the minus n epsilon eta e to the n times lambda of eta, and this integral here is the probability that Fn twiddle lies between minus and plus epsilon. Okay, but this probability of Fn twiddle, this is something which we can control by the law of large number, because 0 is the mean of this guy. So if n goes to infinity, this probability goes to 1 for any epsilon. It's just the law of large number for Fn twiddle. So this goes to 1, and so this means we have some control over this quantity, and I mean, you see that those factors show up here. Of course, this goes to 1, but of course this doesn't go to 1, but it gets very small, but in a way which we can control. Good, so by the law of large numbers, of large numbers, we know that Fn twiddle converges to its mean, so the mean of the xi twiddle under the mu twiddle, that this was chosen in such a way that this is 0, so this means in particular that the limit n going to infinity of the probability that Fn twiddle is between plus and minus epsilon goes to 1 for any epsilon bigger than 0. Okay, and now we can put this all together. So what we really want to show is that we can, for any delta, we can estimate the lim-inf, n going to infinity, of 1 over n of the log of p minus delta as n between minus delta and plus delta. Okay, and with this calculation I can relate this with the corresponding probability for the Fn twiddle, Yeah. Okay. But I mean, I want to introduce this epsilon because I want to send this to zero in the end. So let us fix the delta, a small delta, but introduce epsilons which are smaller than this. And of course, this quantity is decreasing in epsilon or in delta. So this means this is at least bigger. And if I make the delta smaller, let's say I call it epsilon, so this is bigger than the limit, n going to infinity, the same quantity where I just put there epsilon. Okay, and now I take, so I'm taking the limit of this quantity, okay, but and now I want to estimate it, I want to see it, it's bigger than something, so this goes in the right direction, and I mean this quantity goes to 1. So the only thing which survives is this quantity, and I take the limit, I take the log, and then I divide by n, so the n goes away, so I remain with epsilon times eta minus this guy here. I also have so what I remain with, it's bigger than lambda of eta minus epsilon times the absolute value of eta. Okay, and you see what I have here is this term, which I don't really want, but I mean, I can make epsilon as small as I want, so it really disappears. This is true for any epsilon bigger than zero and smaller than delta, but now I can send epsilon to zero, so what I really get is that this guy here is bigger than this here. So it follows, by epsilon going to zero, that's what I want to estimate, is bigger than lambda of eta. And that is really what I wanted to show, because lambda of eta, okay, it should be here. The limit, okay, good. But I mean, if I'm going to here, I know that it's actually a limit, because this has a limit, and I mean, okay, this also has a limit. Okay, but here still, I don't know the limit. Okay, good. So this lambda at eta was chosen in such a way that it was the point where lambda takes on its minimum, so this is the inf over all lambda, and this is by definition lambda star of zero, minus lambda star of zero. And then we actually have what we wanted to show, namely that the limit of this probability is actually bigger than lambda star at this point. Okay, and that's it. And I mean, what we have proved now, more or less, is Cramer's theorem in one dimension. Okay, and now some conditions. Oh, okay, but so you see that this really gives us an estimate for probabilities of some small intervals here. Okay, and we can see that they are bigger than e to the minus this guy here, e to the minus n times lambda star of zero. Okay, so this is Cramer's theorem, and maybe I make a break here. And then, so let's say we meet again 20 after, and then I want to transfer this more or less to Sarnoff theorem, and then hope to come back to random matrices. Okay, so let's have a break for 6 or 7 minutes.
Good. So, let us continue. So what I have shown more or less is Cramer's theorem in one dimension, and I mean more or less the same way you can prove it in higher dimensions. And let me write it down in R to the D. In D dimensions, R to the D. Okay, the setting is the same, so I have independent identically distributed Fremen variables, IID, but they are RD valued. And again, I denote the distribution by mu, but mu is now a probability measure on RD. So it's distribution mu, so this is a probability measure on RD. And again, we consider this Clairaut generating function, but this is now, of course, a function on D variables, and it's E to the E lambda I, it's the inner product between lambda I and xi. This is a number in, this is just lambda, this is a number in RD, and this is a RD valued random variable. I can take again the Lorentz transform, lambda star of x. X, of course, now is also something in R to the D. So it's a sup over lambda in R to the D. Of the inner product now, I have to pair lambda with x, and I take minus lambda of lambda. Okay, and let me assume that lambda of lambda is less than infinity for all lambda in R to the D. I mean, this is some kind of assumption on mu. I mean, one can formulate it in more general, but I mean that is more or less the assumption which ensures, and what I did before, that I had that this convex function lambda really had this form, and it has this unique minimum. Otherwise, there might be some things one has to take care of. Okay, and then I consider Sn. This is the average of the first n variables, as before. Of course, again, it's now RD valued. And then, Cramer's theorem states that the sequence of the distributions of this Sn satisfies a large deviation principle. And maybe I write it now down a little bit more formally, what really means this large deviation. Oh, yeah, the log. Good. So the statement is then the sequence of the distributions of Sn, which are probability measures on Rn, so this satisfies a large deviation principle. And large deviation principle has a quite specific, a bit technical meaning, but let me write it down what it usually means. So it's a large deviation principle. And a large deviation principle has a rate function, and the rate function is, as before, it's this lambda star. So this lambda star. Okay, and what does it mean? So this large deviation principle. So it means, of course, it means first of all the rate function should have some nice properties. And what you usually would like to have is that it is lower semi-continuous. But in our context, actually, it's a convex function. So in general, you don't need convexity for large deviation. So lower semi-continuity is usually what is enough, but I mean, in our case, actually, it's a convex function. Then it should also be good in some sense, which has a precise technical meaning. So good means that some kind of level set with respect to this function should be compact, so that you really have good enough topological property. So the x in RD, for which lambda star of x is less than alpha for any given alpha, this should be compact. Does it make here any sense? Lambda star of x. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So lambda. Okay. Lambda. Lambda is defined in R to the D, but it takes its real value. So for any alpha, this should be compact, and then you want to have the large deviation, you want to have the estimate that the probability of some event essentially goes exponentially in n with the rate, and the coefficient of the rate function. So and this comes down to having two estimates, one estimate from above and one from below. So, and actually, what you really show is that for any class set in R to the D, the lim sub n going to infinity of 1 over n of the log of the probability that Sn is in this set, I mean, that's a replacement what we did before. We are looking on sets where Sn was bigger than x, or maybe on small intervals. Okay, in general, you are looking for one estimate on closed sets, and for the other one, you are looking on open sets. Okay, so here you have closed sets. That this lim sub, you estimate it from above, less than the infimum over lambda star of x, if x is running over your set f. And then the estimate from below, you have to show it for open set. I mean, that was where we showed it essentially for the small intervals. I mean, here usually you're trying to do it for balls, something like this. I mean, open set, if you can find a ball for which you have high enough probability, then you are done. So the estimate here usually is somehow for balls, but I mean, more general, it's for open sets. For all open sets in R to the D, we should show that the lim hinge 1 over n of log Tsn in G is bigger than minus infimum of lambda star of x. That is again running over this set. Okay, that's what you technically mean with the large deviation principle. And I mean, more or less, we have shown this in a one-dimensional case. Good. Okay, so what we have here, I mean, so if you say it a little bit less formally, I mean, so we have that the probability that Sn is close to x behaves like e to the minus n lambda star of x. Oh, I mean, that's the technical way of saying this. But now you might say, okay, I mean, this is nice, but what has this really to do with the problem in which we are interested? Because what we are interested in is not really Sn, but if you're thinking about our random matrices, but it was the empirical distribution, where we're putting mass 1 over n on each of the lambdas. So, I mean, we are not really interested in Sn, but in this guy here, 1 over n, delta of x1 plus delta of xn. And furthermore, I mean, we would like to the rate function, I mean, I'm saying this should be like an entropy, and I mean, in this context, it's not so clear why this should be an entropy. Okay. So, if you're going to this situation, then these things become much clearer, and I mean, the statement about this one, that is, this is Sanoff's theorem, but actually, in a specific case, I mean, I want to show, I mean, you can get Sanoff's theorem as a special, you can derive it from this one, if you have the case of random variables where you have only a finite number of values. Okay, so that's what I want to show, that in this case, I mean, you can use Sanoff's theorem to get information about this, and then you really realize that the rate function is really a kind of entropy as you really know, the classical one. Good. Okay, I mean, in general, Sanoff's theorem is more general, I mean, you have to prove it separately, but I mean, in special cases, you can get it from Cramer's theorem, and so let us just look on this. So consider the special case that the xi's take on only a finite number of variables. So you can say they take on values in a finite alphabet. Of course, it could be real numbers or whatever, but it doesn't really matter. Okay, so this A is a finite set, A1 up to AD, and then, of course, the distribution of our x's is just the probability that x takes on one of those values. So it's just, I mean, it's just a discrete probability. So I have just p1 up to pv, and the pk is just the probability that xi takes on the value ak. Okay, good. And I mean, for this axis, I want to consider a large deviation for this one. And in this situation, I really can encode the xi with some other random variables yi, such that Cramer's theorem essentially gives me a large deviation for this guy. So namely what I'm doing is I encode somehow the information about the axis in an RD-valued random variables, yi. They go from omega, but they go to RD, and I mean, so they have D components. D is the number of elements which I have here, and I mean in each component, I'm just checking whether xi takes on this value ai or not. So this yi, this is just a characteristic function of a1. So in the first component, it's 0 or 1 according to whether xi is i1. In the second component, it's 0 or 1 according to whether xi takes on the value a2 or not, and so on. 1 up to ad, xi. Good. Okay, so this means, I mean, I'm just, and then, so this means that yi take on values, just a d-tuple where exactly one of the components is 1. And if this the component is 1, that component which xi takes on as its value. Okay, good. So this means pk in terms of these yi is nothing else than the probability that yi takes on the value, it has zeros, and then it has 1 at some place, and this place is the kth position. Okay, so if xi is equal to ak, then yi is equal to this guy which has a 1 at this position k. Well, so it's just another way of encoding the information about the axis. But I'm encoding them in a RD-valued way. And then, if I'm taking... Okay, then of course one should... The yi's are also independent. Huh? Okay. And one should think about what is now the sum, average sum over the y's, to what does this correspond if I'm now taking y1 plus yn divided by n. So what does this give me? This gives me essentially, this gives me the relative frequency of occurrences of a1. So in the first, I mean, this is a d-tuple, and the first component tells me how often did a1 occur. a1 as an outcome of xi. The second component, I know how often did a2 occur. So what I get here is the relative frequency of a1 in the first component, and so on, and the relative frequency of ad in the last component. Okay. Because I mean, whenever xi is a1, I mean the corresponding y1 will have a 1 in this component. Okay, and I'm dividing everything by n. So I'm counting essentially every occurrence with a 1 over n and putting it in a relative component, but that's exactly the same information which I want to capture with this guy here. So this is exactly the information as 1 over n of delta of x1 plus delta of xn. Okay, because I mean this really counts how often did I see a1, how often did I see a2, and so on, how often did I see an. And each occurrence is counted with 1 over n. I'm putting 1 over n at the outcome. I mean x1 might be a1, a2, up and so on. If x1 is a1, then I'm putting the mass 1 over n at a1. If x1 is a2, then I'm putting mass 1 over n at a2.
But it's a vector, what you have on the left. If you take dot with 1, 1, 1, 1.
Yeah, I mean, here it's a vector, but this vector here, I'm saying it contains the same information. Here it's a probability measure. Huh? It's a probability measure which are putting masses on the a's. Okay, but I identify this probability measure with a vector by saying what is the mass. This probability measure just lives on A1 up to AD. So I'm just encoding this by just writing down the masses for these B different atoms. clear.
No,
this means it contains the same information. I mean what I have here, this is a vector. Okay, so this is the vector Q1 up to Qt of positive numbers between 0 and 1, which add up to 1. Okay, and this I can identify with a probability measure on A1 up to AB, by just saying the probability of A1 is Q1, the probability of A2 is Q2. In this sense, this corresponds to this one. If this guy here is equal to Q1 up to Qd, then this is the same as saying that 1 over n delta x1 plus delta xn is Q1 delta A1 plus and so on plus Qd delta Ad. I think this is okay, huh?
Okay.
And this
delta sub capital X?
Yeah, here these are my random variables xi. These are the random variables. I mean, x1 is a random variable which takes on the value a1 up to ad. Okay, and I mean, of course, this is a random measure, and this is a random number.
Yeah.
Okay.
A random vector,
yeah.
Yeah,
okay, let's say, we are looking at an event that x1 is equal to a1, x2 is a3, and x3 is a1. Okay, then what is this here, this guy here, how do I'm encoding this, then this is just a probability measure which puts mass 2/3 at a1 and 1/3 at a3. Just saying that I have two occurrences of A1 and one of A3. Okay, but in this way, if I'm rewriting this in the Y, so what is the corresponding Y1? Y1 here, this is 1, 0, 0, Y2 is 0, 0, 1, and Y3 is 1, 0, 0. So if I'm adding up those guys, what do I get? Here I'm taking just Y1 plus Y2 plus Y3 divided by 3. So what do I get? I get 1/3 of 2, 0, 1. Huh? So it's the same, it's the same information as here. It tells me with 2/3, I saw the first letter. With 1/3, I saw the third one. Huh? So these two quantities have exactly the same information, but one is just encoded as an average. Essentially, it's not a number, but it's in D table, but the other one is really a random probability measure. Okay, but I have a finite alphabet, so a probability measure on a finite number of elements is just a d-tuple of probabilities. Okay, it's just this correspondence. But it really allows me to consider this quantity in which I'm interested really as an average of something. So if I want to say something about large deviations for this guy, I can use Cramer's theorem, because I know Cramer's theorem for the average. Good, okay, motivating things might just confuse sometimes. I want to give you a kind of proof for Sanov's theorem in case of a finite alphabet. You also would like to see that you get an entropy. Cramer's theorem might not be so clear why should we call it entropy, but in this case, I hope that you will see that it's really an entropy. So what does Cramer tell us then for this situation? Okay, so what we really want is the probability that 1 over n delta x1 plus delta xn, so this is a random probability measure, and we want to say the probability that this is a given probability measure. Okay, and the probability measure we identified with a d-tuple. The probability measure on d points, we identified with a d-tuple of numbers between 0 and 1, which add up to 1. So let's say q1 up to qd. Okay, so this is a probability measure on our set A, on our final set A. Okay, but now we can also say this is the same as the probability that y1 plus yn divided by n is approximately just this d-tuple, q1 up to qd. Because if I'm adding up those guys, it's really just this d-tuple. Okay, but then, grammar tells us exactly how this behaves, meaning this goes like b to the minus n, and what do I get here? I get the number star of q1 up to qd, where this lambda star is a Legendre transform of lambda, and lambda is what? So lambda is now lambda 1 up to lambda b, so it's a function of d variables, it's the logarithm of the expectation of e lambda comma yi. Okay, but what is this? So this is the expectation. So this yi, this is a d vector, but it can only take on the values where at one position I have a 1, at the other I have 0, and this, if this position is k, this occurs with the probability pk. So what I have here is the log of p1. So with p1, I have here y1 takes on the value 1, 0, 0, 0, multiplying it with lambda, just gives me lambda 1. So it's e to the lambda 1. Then this probability p2, this takes on the value 0, 1, 0, and so on. So I get p2 times e to the lambda 2, and so on. Pd, e to the lambda b. Okay, so this is a very concrete, precise expression, and we can calculate the Legendre transform of this guy. So the Legendre transform, so lambda star of q1 up to qd, what is this? This is by definition the sup over all the lambdas in Rd of the inner product between lambda and q, so this means lambda 1, q1 plus lambda d qd minus lambda of lambda 1 up to lambda d. And lambda is this expression. Okay, so we have to take the sup of this, and of course for doing this, everything is differentiable, so we find the lambdas which maximize this guy by saying that the partial derivatives of this guy with respect to lambda should be equal to 0. So, let us quickly do this. So we maximize what we have there in this bracket as a function of lambda 1 up to lambda b, and if you calculate the derivative of this with respect to lambda I, what do you get? Here the lambda I appears with the factor qi, so you get a qi, and then you have to take the derivative of this guy, which we can also do, we get the log, so this gives 1 over this guy, and then, the lambda I also appears somewhere here, so we get the exponential function, times pi. So what we get is minus 1 over this guy, p1 e to the lambda 1 plus pd e to the lambda d, and we get pi times e to the lambda I. Okay, we want this to be equal to 0, and this means essentially we can solve this for lambda I. We want to get the lambda I. So from this it follows that lambda I is equal. Okay, so we bring this on the other side. We get qi divided by pi. And then we get the log of this guy plus the log of p1 e lambda 1 plus pd e lambda d. Okay, but which is nothing else than lambda of lambda 1 up to lambda d. And we have not really solved for lambda I because it also shows up here. It's just an implicit equation. But nevertheless, it's good enough because what we want to do, we have to plug in this minimizing lambda into this guy and then get the value. And miraculously, this guy falls out. So it's not really an explicit solution for the lambda I. It's good enough because what is the lambda star? Now, qi up to QD. So it's this quantity evaluated at these values of the lambda i's, because those are the ones which maximize this quantity. So what is it? So I have to take the lambda is this guy plus this. So let me take this one. So I multiply the lambda with the Q, with this first term. So I get the Q1 times the log of P1 divided, no, Q1 divided by P1 plus and so on plus QD log of QD divided by PD. Then, the lambdas also contain this factor here, so I also get, but it's always the same factor for each lambda. So I just multiply it with the Q, with the Q1 and the Q2 and so on, so I have Q1 plus QD times lambda. Okay, and then I have to subtract this lambda, here again, minus this lambda. Okay, but now miraculously, the Q's, probability vector, so the sum is 1, and this lambda just goes away. If it wouldn't, I wouldn't have a nice solution. So this goes away, and what I'm left is this quantity, and I hope that everybody agrees that this really is an entropy. And what this is the relative entropy of the Q's with respect to the P's, of the probability vector Q with respect to the probability vector P. And P is in a sense the most likely realization, because the P's are really the probabilities with which my axes take on these various values. Okay, so you see, we really have a relative entropy with respect to the P, and the P is the most likely one, the one which we expect. Okay, so what I got here, this quantity here, let me denote it by H of the vector Q1 up to QD with respect to the vector P1 up to PD. And this is a very well-known quantity, so that is what is called the relative entropy of this guy with respect to this one. Relative entropy of QI with respect to PI. Okay, and in particular, this quantity, when is it minimal, one can easily see that it's the minimal value is 0, and this is achieved exactly if the PIs are equal to the QIs. Because then, this is 1, so yeah, then everything vanishes. Okay, that's the minimal value. So it's minimal if and only if the QIs are the PIs. Good, okay, so this means PI is the most likely realization, the one which we expect, that we get it if n goes to infinity, and all the other realizations, they are exponentially unlikely. And how much are they unlikely? It's measured by the relative entropy. Cramer's theorem tells us these probabilities. Okay, but now we have identified this guy. This is really the relative entropy of the Q's with respect to the P's. Good. Okay, so in this example, one sees very concretely, I hope, that the rate function is really an entropy. And in a sense, it's given by the logarithm of the approximations of somehow the macroscopic state, QI, by microscopic states of this form. So how many possibilities do I have to get this? Good. Okay, so what I have shown you here is Zanoff's theorem for finite alphabet, in which case you can get it from Cramer's theorem, but you can also prove it much more general if you have real valued random variables, and then of course you have to prove it more directly. So, but let me state it, write it down, because this is maybe the one which is most relevant for us, and which should have a free analog. Good. Okay, so Zanoff's theorem in general, if the axes are just real valued random variables, x1, x2, and so on, let them be IID real valued random variables, and with a distribution mu, so mu is just a probability measure on R, and then again we consider mu n, which is this empirical distribution, so it puts, it's a random probability measure which puts mass 1 over n on each of the outcomes of x1 up to xn, so this empirical distribution, so this is a random probability measure on R, and then, okay, then mu n satisfies, that's a statement of Flanagan's theorem, satisfies a large deviation principle. Okay, and what is the rate function? The rate function is again a relative entropy, but now in a continuous setting. So we have rate function I of mu, which is the relative entropy of mu with respect to mu, so it is mu, which is the most likely outcome of this, where everything concentrates in the limit, but deviations from this go exponentially with this rate function, and this rate function is the relative entropy, so which I can again write down, I mean the continuous version of this formula which I had before, so namely if mu has a density with respect to p, then it's the integral over p of x log p of x d mu x if mu has a density, and if it doesn't have a density, then in a sense it's too far away from mu. I mean, then there's no chance of really having high probabilities of seeing it, and then it's just plus infinity otherwise, which means probability of seeing such a thing are very small. Okay, and I mean, of course, if you write down concretely what this means, I mean, you have to do it in this this way. Good. But okay, then maybe let us go back to random matrices. So what does this mean for random matrices? So for the diagonal ones, where I have independent, where I choose diagonal matrices with independent entries on the diagonal, we will give a mu. I mean, this tells me, yeah, I mean, I can just read this theorem in this setting. Go back to random matrices. Okay, so for diagonal ones, diagonal matrices, Dn, then I mean the probability, so recall, I mean Dn, so this means I have n by n matrices by diagonal, and I choose the element on the diagonal independently with distribution mu. Mu is a fixed distribution, as I have. There, then the probability that Dn has an eigenvalue distribution, which is nothing else than this empirical distribution, and that this is close to some mu, I mean this is the same as mu dn close to mu, and so I mean according to Flanagan's theorem we know that this goes to e to the minus n times the relative entropy of mu comma mu. Okay, so I mean this is just rewriting, I mean instead of writing the random variables as a tuple, you write it as a diagonal element in a diagonal matrix. I mean, nothing really has happened. I mean, there's no need for using matrices there, and of course in classical probability theory you don't do it. But if you want to go to compare, I mean to go over to Gaussian random matrices, it's nice to compare things with diagonal matrices. And the classical, yeah? I mean, this means a probability measure which puts mass 1 over n on each of the eigenvalues, which of course are now just the elements on the diagonal. So this is exactly the same quantity as the mu n above. Good. Okay, but now you can ask the question, is there an analog for Gaussian random matrices? Okay, so let us again consider our probability measure Pn on Gaussian random matrices, which was given by the fact, okay, it's a constant times e to the minus n over 2 trace of a squared times dA. So just saying that the entries are independent and have Gaussian distribution. And of course, if you want to calculate something, I mean, what you want are not the entries of your matrix, but the eigenvalues, so you should rewrite this distribution as a distribution for the eigenvalues. Okay, that's a very well known thing how to do this. So, namely for the eigenvalue distribution, let me denote this by twiddle, T and twiddle, of B. So this is the probability of the matrices for which the eigenvalues are in the set B. So B is just an n-tuple, lambda n of A, in B. And then one knows how to do this. Essentially, you have to transform your density from the entries to the diagonals, and what you get, the main thing is that you get a determinant, which is a Jacobian, essentially, of making this transformation. But this is well known, and you can calculate it. So one knows that you get exactly this repulsion factor, lambda I minus lambda j squared, coming from this transformation. So one knows that the density of the eigenvalues of a Gaussian random matrix ensemble is given by some normalizing constant. Then, of course, you have this factor, because you have written it in the traces. Of course, it's just the sum of the square of the eigenvalues. So in eigenvalues, you just get e to the minus n over 2, the sum of the lambda I squared. So this is just rewriting this factor in eigenvalues. But then you get a Jacobian by transforming the differential from the entries to the eigenvalues. And you're integrating away the angles. So of course, you're losing things, but you're not interested in them. You're integrating over them. But the Jacobian from going from here to here gives you this factor, this product of lambda I minus lambda j squared. And then you have the differentials of the eigenvalues. Okay, and the squares come from the fact that you have complex matrices. For real ones, you would have to the power 1 and so on. Okay, and of course, without this factor, you would just have independent eigenvalues. But this factor makes a coupling between them, and they are not independent anymore. So the eigenvalues of random matrices are not independent anymore. Maybe actually one can also write down what this Cn is. So this Cn, this is n to the n squared over 2 pi n over 2 times the product of j factorials, j from 1 up to n. This is essentially, it's the integral over this guy, or 1 over this integral, because you have to normalize it to 1, the integral over all lambdas. Okay, this is a kind of fallback integral, so you one can look it up somewhere. It's not a trivial integral, but it's known what this is. Good. Okay, and now, if you have this concrete formula, then you really, you can calculate large gradients. Let me just give you somehow the idea, the heuristic, or just what we expect for the rate function. Of course, proving it is not so easy, but it can be done. But, it's quite easy to get an idea of how the rate function should look like in this context. So namely, we expect under this probability distribution, so Pn, that mu A, the eigenvalue distribution under our Gaussian ensemble, is close to some distribution mu. So what is this? So this is the probability that under this eigenvalue distribution, this 1 over n, delta lambda 1 plus delta lambda n is close to mu. Okay, and we have to join the eigenvalue distribution of the lambdas. So this probability essentially means we should integrate over a neighborhood of mu with respect to this density here. And then we should somehow try to see whether we can get a feeling for how this probability behaves for large n. Good, and so what is this? So this is Cn times the integral over some neighborhood, of mu, so delta lambda 1 plus delta lambda n should be close to mu. Okay, and then we have to integrate over e to the minus n over 2, sum over lambda I squared, this product of lambda I minus lambda j squared, and the differentials. Okay, but so what is this? So if this is a very small neighborhood, somehow things should concentrate somewhere. So assume, we are in this neighborhood, so that this guy here is very close to nu. But then, if you are very close to nu, essentially, the things which we have here essentially are just functions of nu. I mean, we can write them as functions of nu. So in particular, minus n over 2, the sum over lambda I squared, I from 1 up to n, so let us write this as minus n squared over 2 times 1 over n, the sum over lambda I squared. Okay, but this is now, I mean, the average over the lambda I squared, and the lambda I squared are essentially very close to nu, so this here should be very close to the second moment of nu. So this should be quite close to x squared uni x. Because lambda I's, I mean, we are in a neighborhood where they should approximate nu, so this integral, this sum here should approximate this integral. Okay, then of course the main thing is really this factor here, which really makes a difference to the case of independent random variables. And what is this? And this is of course, I should have left this. So the product over lambda I minus lambda j squared. So this is, if you want to write things as an exponential, this guy here we have as an exponential, huh? So we have e to the minus this. Okay, this guy is not written as an exponential, but I mean we want to see an exponential decay, so we should try to bring everything in exponential form. So we write this as the exponential over the sum I less than j of the log of lambda I minus lambda j squared. Okay, we take this factor 2 and maybe, okay, we remove this condition and just say that I should be different from j log lambda I minus lambda j. Okay, and again, I mean, this is a sum where we are summing over I and j, we are writing the diagonal, of course this would explode, okay, but otherwise this should be very close to double integral. I mean the lambda should be very close to nu, so this should be, if you divide it by n squared, it should be very close to a double integral, so this means this should behave here like n squared times the log of x minus y d nu x. Nu y. Well, I mean the lambda i's are very close to being distributed like nu. Okay, so I have this. Good. Okay, and of course, I mean this here is really something which has to be justified. In particular, I mean we are writing the diagonal, and I mean the log has a singularity. Yes, I mean this is purely formal. I mean if you want to prove this, there is quite some work to do there. But at least from this, I mean, one would expect that Pn of nu A close to nu, that this should behave like e to the minus, and you see we get an n squared, I mean we have an n squared here, and n squared here, but which is reasonable because I mean we have a matrix, so we have more or less n squared independent degrees of freedom. Okay, so we have here n squared, and then what do we have here? We should have here a function which depends on nu, and what have we seen here? So this I of nu, so this is first of all this integral here, so it's minus this logarithmic integral x minus y dx d nu y. Then we have this factor here, so it's just the second moment plus 1/2 integral of x squared d mu of x. And then one has to be a little bit careful because I also have my constant here. And in this case, I mean, this constant has a kind of exponential growth. So I should also write this as e to something, and it has a limit. I mean, so it was exactly what Jonathan assessed before. I mean, in the case before, the constant didn't really matter much. Its behavior with n was so tame that it didn't have an exponential component. But in this case, if we have a component there, so we also have to take this into account. But I mean, this can be calculated. So it's 1 over n squared of the log of cn. So this is something, and I think it's in this case it's 6 over 8. Okay, but it's just one number. Okay, good. And I mean, that's what we would expect, but of course this was quite formal, but I mean this theorem was actually proved by Benaroos and Guinée in 97, and maybe in the last minus 5 minutes I just write this down so that we have at least a formal theorem about free entropy in a one-dimensional situation, of course. I mean, the whole point here is that one can really calculate things if one has one matrix, because one has a joint eigenvalue distribution for the eigenvalues, and one, you can deal with eigenvalue distributions. If you have several matrices, I mean, there are no formulas around this which you could work, and then it's getting much harder. Good. Okay, that's all. By Benaroos and DNA in 97, so they have shown that if you take exactly this I as before, so I of mu as before, as I have written it down, and then one has that this I actually is a function which qualifies as a rate function, so it has good enough properties. So this I is a function from probability measures on R. It takes on values, and of course it can also have the value plus infinity. I mean, this integral, this double integral, for example, doesn't need to exist, but it's then plus infinity. So I mean, you never got minus infinity, but you might get plus infinity, and I mean, it can take on those values, but that's okay. I mean, for a large deviation, this is okay. This just means these are situations which are very far away from the typical value, if you have plus infinity. Okay, so this is well defined. It's also convex, and it's a good function in this technical sense, which I told you before. And actually, it also has a unique minimum, which of course should correspond to the typical value which I see in my limit theorem, which is Wigner's theorem. And of course, this must be the semisocle. So there's a unique minimum of this function, which is achieved at the semisocle. It has a unique minimum at which it takes on the value 0. Okay, and of course this minimum has to be the semicircle. And of course it's the semicircle which arises as the limit in our normalization. So it's a semicircle, I mean the usual normalization living from minus 2 to plus 2. Good. Okay, and then the main point, of course, is that this I is really the rate function for a large deviation principle in this empirical distribution under